All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. We're right on time. I've got a whole bunch of content to go through today, and I'm going to try and go through it as slowly as I possibly can, but I got to make sure I get to the end. So I'm going to start right on time, and we'll try and make sure we keep up the pace as we go today. So my name is Jeff Mieliff. I'm a program manager in the Office 365 team at Microsoft. I've been working on Exchange for about 15 years, mostly, well, all in the engineering team, working on performance, scalability, sizing, those aspects of the product. And today's session is really about monitoring and tuning. I actually sat in a couple of sessions earlier in the week that made reference to the session I was going to be giving today, where I got called out for providing sizing guidance. I'm actually not going to be talking too much about sizing guidance today. I will give you some references where you can see details on our sizing guidance for 2013. But I like to think of this session as part two. Once you've actually gone through the sizing process and figured out how to deploy, and you've gone through that process of getting deployed, how can you actually tune things to get the best utilization out of your hardware? How can you monitor the system to make sure that, that things stay healthy? And how can you troubleshoot issues that will come up over time? So in the limited amount of time that we have today, I'm going to go through some thoughts on those major points, and I'll provide some resources as well for both the kind of pre-material, the sizing guidance, the tools that are used to actually figure out what you need in terms of hardware to deploy Exchange 2013 on, as well as other resources that you can use beyond what we have time to talk about today to learn more. So I've kind of broken up the session into three major components. We're going to talk about optimizing your deployment of Exchange 2013, ways to think about tuning the platform that Exchange sits on, ways to think about tuning Windows, tuning the hardware that you're running on, and ways to think about actually balancing your utilization of that hardware. We'll talk quite a bit about balance. That's a term that's going to come up over and over again today. We'll spend a bit of time talking about troubleshooting. A lot of what I've spent time on over the years in my role at Microsoft has involved troubleshooting. Pretty much every team that I've been on, I've spent some of my time dealing with what we call CRITSITs, or critical escalations that come in from customers with Premier support that have been major performance problems. So I have a fair amount of experience dealing with those, and I'll give you some hints about how to approach some of those problems, how to think about trying to resolve some of those issues that might come up in your own deployments. And then we'll talk briefly at the end about trending, how to actually collect information from Exchange and use that over time to try and predict where things are going so that you can try and avoid some of these performance problems and stay out of that troubleshooting section as much as possible. Hopefully we'll have time for some Q&A. I've tried to aim for about an hour of content, which means we should have about 15 minutes for questions. If we don't get to all the questions, I do have time in the office booth on the show floor tomorrow, and I'll point out when that time is later. One quick point before I move on. If you downloaded the PowerPoint deck from the Schedule Builder, there's a whole bunch of changes in what I'm presenting today from the deck that's out there now. That link down at the bottom, you can right now get the updated version of the deck that I'm about to present. I will put that link up again at the end. And I will make sure that Schedule Builder gets updated with the current version of the deck, but that usually takes a little bit of time. If you want the deck now for whatever reason, that link will take you to my personal OneDrive and you can go grab it. Okay, so let's talk about how to optimize your deployment of Exchange 2013. So, I mentioned I wasn't going to be talking too much about sizing. This is about the extent of the sizing guidance I'm going to give. Sizing is extremely important, right? You need to really think through what resources Exchange needs in order to be successful, and make sure that you actually deploy those. If you don't deploy the resources that Exchange needs, you're going to be in for a world of hurt. Exchange is an extremely resource-hungry application, especially in 2013. How many of you have actually deployed 2013 already? Wow, that's awesome. I expected to see three or four hands. That's great. Apparently, Service Pack 1 makes a big difference, huh? Okay, good. So for those of you who haven't already deployed or and are thinking about it and are in the process of going through that design phase, make sure you get the sizing process right. We have lots of guidance available. There's a fairly lengthy article on the Exchange team blog that goes through all the different resource requirements for Exchange, all the different calculations associated with those requirements. That's the bottom link on the slide that you see up here. And the link above that, the one that ends in MEC, is a recording of a session that I did last month at the Microsoft Exchange Conference in Austin, where I walked through the details behind that information and how to think about those about that guidance as you go through your deployment process. So that's a video out on Channel 9. You can go take a look at that. Like I said, I like to think of that as kind of part one. This is part two when we think about building a healthy Exchange deployment. So when we think about sizing, the easiest way to perform sizing for Exchange is to use our calculator tool. And I highly recommend doing this. Do not try and do the calculations manually. You will make mistakes. I make mistakes running those calculations all the time. But my friend at work, Ross Smith, has provided a great tool in terms of the role requirements calculator for Exchange. It used to be the Exchange storage calculator, and over the years it's kind of grown up, grown into its own, and it now actually sizes much more than just Exchange storage. It provides information about all of the roles for Exchange, well, maybe with the exception of Edge, but we'll get there eventually, and provides details about server sizing, not just storage sizing. So you can put in information about how your users utilize Exchange, the number of messages they send and receive per user per day, the size of messages that are running through your organization, the size of mailboxes, and it'll help you actually kind of model what your different options are for meeting those requirements. Storage is still a major component of that. You know, even though we've reduced our IOPS requirements over the years with Exchange, we do still have a very hefty dependence on storage. So the calculator will go through and provide some storage options for you. It'll tell you your CPU requirements, your memory requirements, make some great recommendations. And it'll also actually provide some scripts that will create databases for you, create database copies if you're going to use a DAG, and actually you know, help to build that deployment once you have the hardware. So it's not just a calculator anymore. Highly recommend that you use that. I will point out or call out the item that's in the green box on the slide. I mentioned that Exchange 2013 is very resource heavy, particularly around CPU. Our CPU guidance has gone up pretty dramatically in Exchange 2013, and it actually went up even more with SP1, with the introduction of the MAPI over HTTP protocol. If you attempt to compare our CPU guidance between 2013 and 2010, you might get really upset, because it looks worse than it is. If you just directly try and compare the numbers, it might look like, you know, we increased our CPU requirements by 4x or 8x or something like that. It's not really that bad. We changed the way that we measured CPU requirements between the two releases. Basically, we changed the baseline platform that we use to generate those numbers. And as a result, if you really want to make that comparison, go figure out what the calculator for 2010 would have required in terms of hardware, and compare that to what the calculator for 2013 requires in terms of hardware. That's a much more realistic comparison. So don't look at the raw numbers. That's the key point there. OK, let's talk about how to optimize the platform that Exchange is sitting on once you've actually started deployment and gotten through the sizing process. So power, certainly something that is top of mind for a lot of folks today when we think about you know, deployment in data centers and resource requirements in data centers. Power, space, cooling, these are things that we spend a lot of money on. And you know, 14 years ago or 15 years ago when I started at Microsoft and we were producing sizing guidance, we didn't think so much about power. That wasn't really something that that came to mind or we talked about very frequently. But over the years, power has become a really important aspect of performance and tuning and thinking about how the application uses the system. We want to make sure that that you know we're being mindful of those resource requirements, trying to reduce our footprint in the data center as much as possible. So power utilization is really about a balance between the throughput of the system and energy efficiency. So the OS has a number of settings that you can use. You know, we do this on our laptops all the time. We try and turn down our power utilization to extend our battery life, right? You can do the same thing on servers. And by default, when you bring up a new Windows Server machine, it's going to be in the balanced power profile. And balanced is generally fine. Don't have a problem with balanced. We do recommend that if you want to get the absolute best exchange performance out of the box, or if you're going to go run some benchmarking, or if you want to really see what that hardware is truly capable of, that you switch it over to high performance. There's a few things that are going to change. Well, actually, there's a bunch of things that are going to change as a result of that switch. You're not going to have any of your CPU cores getting parked. In other words, all of your CPU is always going to be up and running all the time and available for exchange and other services that are running on that box to use. That means that the operating system isn't going to have work to do in order to try and dynamically tune the number of CPUs that are available and you know try and park those at various times to minimize power utilization. If you are sizing based on our you know normal guidelines that you don't size for greater than 80% CPU utilization, as an example, you're probably going to be fine with balanced CPU as a power profile. If you run into the case where you're low on CPU and you need some additional resources, there are a few things that you can do in sort of that emergency situation. This is one potential thing that you can do to try and eke a little more horsepower out of the system. So just be aware of that. I think in general, you know, balance is probably okay for most of our customers. High performance is an option. And it's also something you may want to consider if you're a heavy user of UM. Right? High performance is typically recommended where you need really low latency transactions running through the CPU. When you're thinking about AV type applications, voice applications like unified messaging, you need really low latency to the CPU for good voice quality. So, UM, high performance may be something you want to consider. The trade-off is more power utilization, which also turns around to mean more cooling in your data center environment. The last point on the slide, most modern server equipment allows the BIOS to manage power or the operating system to manage power. You don't want them both to think that they're managing power. That leads to some really interesting behavior. So in general, our guidance here, if the BIOS on the server has a setting that allows you to control this, make sure it's letting the operating system make the decisions. The OS has a lot more information about what's going on the server in order to be able to make good decisions about the right things to do to manage power. So hyperthreading is an interesting problem with Exchange 2013. So in 2010, our guidance for hyperthreading was somewhat vague. I think we said, you know, we recommend not doing it. But if you get into a case like I was referring to with the power scenario, where you're running a little low on CPU cycles, you've got a little bit of an emergency, well, maybe hyperthreading is something you could turn on to get you over that hump, right? Hyperthreading will often give you, with Exchange, about a 20 to 30% boost in CPU throughput based on the lab tests that we've done. And that's great. So the guidance for 2010 was, we don't really want you to use it, but if you need it in a pinch, go ahead and turn it on. For 2013, we really want you to leave it off for all scenarios, even if you need that little extra boost. And the reason for that is around memory utilization. Like all performance conversations, this is about trade-offs. It's all about trade-offs. So the trade-off here is between a fair amount of additional memory utilization and that 20 to 30% boost that, you know, that you're not going to be able to consistently get. It's not going to be like you get a 22% boost all the time for all of your Exchange utilization. It's going to average out. You can't really depend on it. The memory utilization comes from the way the .NET framework allocates memory. With the exception of a very small amount of code that we use for our database engine, for JET in Exchange, everything in Exchange 2013 uses managed code, uses the .NET CLR. That means that it's the memory that those services are allocating is all managed memory that uses the .NET garbage collector to deal with keeping things in line. And the way .NET allocates memory in most situations depends on the number of logical CPU cores that it sees when the service or the process starts up. And so think of a process that isn't doing anything. We've just turned the server on. We'll say store as an example, or a store worker process, since we now have a worker process per database. That starts up, and it's going to allocate some memory. If we have 8 logical CPUs on the box, well, that calculation of how much memory is going to be allocated is going to involve a multiplier of 8. If we turn hyperthreading on that machine, we now have 16 logical CPUs. We're now effectively doubling the amount of memory before that worker process has done anything that gets allocated. And it turns out that we don't actually take advantage of that memory. So we went and looked at the amount of memory that was being allocated in our own internal deployments that, for the most part, was never getting used. And we looked at that 20 to 30% boost in CPU throughput. We decided that the trade-off was not really worth it. We didn't think that enabling hyperthreading and using up all of that additional memory was actually worth the boost in CPU. So that's where the guidance comes from. It's very specific in the sizing guidance that we've published. Turn off hyperthreading. You're not going to just, fall over. Exchange is not going to stop functioning if you turn hyperthreading on. But be aware of that trade-off. And wherever possible, we want to make sure that hyperthreading is turned off. There's a slight tweak to this guidance that comes if you're virtualizing. And if you're interested in the details on that, there's also a virtualization session that I did at MEC you can find on Channel 9, where I go through how the guidance is different in that scenario. Don't have time to go into it in this session, but take a look at that if you're interested. Speaking of .NET and memory, when we were going through the release process for Exchange 2013 RTM, we found some really interesting issues with memory utilization, particularly in the store worker processes. And this was due to some behavior that we didn't think made a lot of sense in the way memory was allocated within .NET. So we worked with the .NET team to produce some hotfixes. And these hotfixes actually resulted in our deployments in reductions in memory utilization on the order of hundreds of megabytes. So I highly recommend that you deploy these. They don't change the guidance for the amount of memory that you actually need to deploy on your servers, but they free up available memory so that your server actually can handle spikes better and can generally perform better. We want that memory to be available. We don't want to run at a state of always having a small amount of free memory. We want to actually have a fair amount of free memory available so that the operating system and the Exchange services can use it on demand. This helps to do that. So a couple of key points here. If you're running server 2008 R2 or 2012, there are hotfixes available, right? We want you to deploy those hotfixes, if at all possible, and also to deploy .NET Framework 4.5.1. There's some additional performance fixes in 4.5.1 that are extremely important for Exchange as well, particularly around the usage of MAPI over HTTP. Both of those together give you the best possible experience with .NET Framework for Exchange. Those two hotfixes are not what we call general distribution releases. They are just hotfixes. Unfortunately for you, that means that you actually have to call Microsoft support and say, I want the hotfix. We do that for a couple of reasons. The biggest being that we want to be able to track who gets the hotfix so that if we need to make a change to it and re-release it, we can get in touch with you and make sure you know that there's a new version available of that hotfix. But totally understand that that's not the optimal behavior. It would be better if you could just go and download it. Hopefully we will get to the point that we can just give you that hotfix over time. I've been working on it for a while and still haven't gotten there, but I'll keep working. If, however, you're on 2012 R2, how many people are running server 2012 R2? Awesome. I have great news for you. Deploy .NET Framework 4.5.1, you're good to go. You don't need to do anything else. The fix is in there. Unfortunately, the releases of .NET are also in some ways tied to the version of the operating system, which is why we have to provide this different guidance. Server 2012 R2 provides a whole bunch of benefits for Exchange. This is just one of them. So glad to see so many hands raised. That's fantastic news. So that's all I'm gonna say about this. I would love it if, you know, if you're on that those down-level platforms, that you did take the time to call in the support and get these hot fixes. That'll also help my argument for making them general distribution releases. The more people we have calling in, the better off we are. Yep. The question was, are they available via Premier, or do you still have to call? I believe you still have to call, but you may be able to just email your TAM and ask for them. So network optimizations, another aspect of the profile that Exchange is sitting on. So one of the key messages that came across at MEC last month, the Microsoft Exchange Conference, was that we really recommend focusing on simplicity as a way to think about an Exchange deployment. And when you're making decisions about the best way to design Exchange, simplicity should always win. We've done a whole bunch of work over the last couple of releases to try and remove complexity from storage, to try and remove complexity from server deployment. You know, the architecture of Exchange 2013, moving from what was a, you know, from a much more complex set of roles in 2010 to a much more slimmed down set of roles in 2013. We're trying to take away complexity from the system, but we also want you to think about removing complexity as you make those deployment decisions. Network is one area where our guidance has changed from 2010 to 2013, and that guidance change is really about simplicity. We want you to think about a single NIC for your Exchange servers. Now, we talk a lot about high availability for Exchange and thinking about you know, dealing with failures. You might think, wow, that's an interesting failure domain you've just created there with only having a single NIC on your Exchange mailbox server for 2013. Well, yes, that's true. It does change the kind of failure profile of the system. But this is also about trade-offs. We found that in general, from a bandwidth utilization perspective, we don't really need multiple NICs on these Exchange servers. And we also find that a lot of customers are moving to 10 gig Ethernet. We really don't need more than a single 10 gig Ethernet adapter on an Exchange server. You know, if you're virtualizing, that changes the equation a bit. But I'm not talking about that scenario here. I'm talking about physical deployment. What we find is that if you lose that NIC and you're in a DAG, it's the equivalent of losing the server, right? You deal with a failover, you bring up active copies of databases on another server, and all is fine. The system behaves in the way it was supposed to behave. You're designing for an eventual failure event like that. You know, fix the problem with the NIC, you bring the server back online, you redistribute your databases. No problem, no user perceived downtime, all good. And you don't have multiple NICs that need to be managed, multiple paths to those NICs that need to be managed, and multiple opportunities for mistakes around design. I have a link on the slide to what we call our preferred architecture, which is kind of a, you know, best case scenario for how we would love to see Exchange deployed. Obviously, it's not the way every customer should deploy Exchange. It's very specific to you know, some particular ideas that might make more sense for a large enterprise. Certainly aren't going to make sense for someone with 50, 100, a few hundred mailboxes. You know, there's comments in there about site resiliency. Not everyone needs site resiliency. So keep in mind it's not for everyone, but it does provide some information about why I'm making this comment about a single NIC. There's a question down front. I'm going to ask you to hold your questions just to make sure I get through the multitude of slides, and we'll take them at the end. So thank you. Sorry about that, but got to do that just to make sure we get through. I do recommend using offload features. So if you've been around Exchange for a while, we used to tell you, oh God, do not turn on RSS. Do not use any of the offload features on NICs. You know, your Exchange servers are going to fall over, the sky is going to fall, and it's just going to be awful. This is the Exchange 2003, 2007 timeframe. Things have changed pretty dramatically in the time since then, in terms of the technology around offload functionality with NICs. We absolutely recommend using RSS, and really using the default behavior from an offload perspective of these NICs. You are not going to be able to actually scale to fully utilize a 10 gig Ethernet adapter unless you use RSS. There's no way. RSS is basically allowing Windows to utilize potentially all the CPUs on the box for processing of network traffic coming in from the NIC. Otherwise, it's going to use CPU zero. single CPU on the box, responsible for managing all of that traffic. That just doesn't scale with modern NICs. So absolutely use offload features. It's a departure from our old guidance. Maybe, you know, a little bit surprising if you're coming from an older version of Exchange and an older version of the OS. But Windows, our partners in the network business have done a lot of work to actually make this stuff work well, work reliably, and we're really happy about that because it brings benefits to Exchange. So, IIS. Exchange uses IIS pretty heavily. You go and look at an Exchange 2013 server. Let's just separate out the roles for a second. The CAS role, which is really just a stateless proxy in 2013, is basically, well, with the exception of a few protocols, I'll call them the legacy protocols, like POP and IMAP, and also with the exception of SMTP, it's using IIS. It's running an ASP.NET application to perform HTTP proxy work under IIS. It's proxying to the mailbox role that's also running IIS and running a whole bunch of ASP.NET applications. So there's a bunch of tuning options for ASP.NET and for IIS. If you go through the Windows performance tuning white paper, there's a multitude of configuration parameters. And over the years, we actually have recommended tuning some of those, particularly around connection limits. In general, the guidance here is don't touch anything. We do make some proactive changes when we set up Exchange, specific to the virtual directories that we're using or the websites that we're configuring around connection limits to make sure that we can get through the number of connections that we need. And we don't, in general, want people to go and adjust IIS beyond that. We think that, based on our experience in our own internal deployments, that IIS is going to be tuned the best it can for our workload based on those changes that we make at setup. So, you know, there are little tweaks that you may need to make over time that support might advise you to make as a result of a support case. But in terms of best practices, leave things as they are after setup. That's the advice here. We recently changed advice on page file sizing. So for Exchange 2013, we no longer are saying use the size of RAM plus 10 megs. Exchange 2013 is fairly memory hungry, right? And when you think about actually using size of RAM plus 10 megs, you're looking potentially at, you know, 300 gig page files. That's a lot of space to use up on your system drive. Well, at the same time, we're telling you, hey, go deploy Exchange on your system drive. Use that for your transport queues as well. Well, we actually want to make sure you have as much space as possible on that system drive. And over time, we've gotten much more comfortable with how Exchange uses the page file. And in 2013, we're comfortable saying we don't really want to see that page file bigger than 32 gigs plus 10 megs. We're keeping the 10 megs. We're not going to take that away. And if you're interested in the history of why that 10 megs is added on, happy to cover that. But in reality, it doesn't really matter to this conversation. Just be aware that what we're saying here is no matter the size of RAM that you have, don't size your page file larger than 32,778 megs. We do still want a fixed size page file. In other words, don't let Windows manage the page file. And the reason for that is really very straightforward. If the system is under duress, if it's under pressure, we don't want Windows to be going through and having to increase the size of the page file at that point in time. Increasing the size of files is actually a fairly performance-intensive application from the perspective of Windows. So using that fixed size page file ensures that we're using that amount of space from the very beginning. We're good to go, and we're not going to be dealing with that work at a time that we don't want to have to. So from this point forward in the talk, I actually have an area of the slide that'll be showing up occasionally here with the table that you're seeing here with some perf counters. What I've tried to do as I go through here is call out perf counters that are interesting to keep an eye on related to the topic that I'm referring to. So I'll call out some of the specific perf counters as we go, just for you to be aware of. We do not currently have a document published today that describes what our thresholds are, what the counters are that you should be monitoring, what the thresholds are that define health, like we did for Exchange 2010. That's coming. coming fairly soon. I was hoping to have it released today, but still going through some review process on it. But I am going to call out some of the key counters that that are worth taking a look at, so you can kind of get a head start for those of you that have already deployed 2013 on keeping an eye on your deployments. So the percent committed bytes in use counter is essentially telling you, you know, of those page files or of that page file on your system, how much of it are you using? In general, we expect that to be a fairly low percentage. 80% is the recommended max from the Windows team, so we're going to use that as our threshold. And then available megabytes is another counter that defines essentially the available megabytes of memory for allocation on the box. We recommend that always be at least 5% of RAM. So moving on to storage, speaking of, you know, tuning the platform and resource utilization. This is the international symbol for don't use storage, storage tiering. I just created this, but I'm defining that as the international symbol. So we're not big fans of storage tiering. And when I talk about storage tiering, what I'm referring to is using some intelligence in a storage solution to try and figure out, well, there's two types. There's manual and automatic. What I'm going to describe here is automatic storage tiering. It's using some logic within a storage controller to try and figure out what aspects of your storage are actually being accessed most frequently, and putting those blocks on better, maybe faster storage. So you might have, as an example, a SAN with a few shelves of SSD and a few shelves of slower drives. Well, your storage controller would attempt to figure out what portions of that volume of data that you have is being used or being accessed most frequently, and would migrate as quickly as possible over time those blocks from the slower drives to your SSD tier. That works really well for some workloads. It really doesn't work well for Exchange. And I mentioned that I deal with a lot of performance crit sets for Exchange. This is a frequent topic of those calls. And the problem here is that it's very hard to predict what Exchange data is actually going to be hot at any moment in time. It changes over time. And that means that the storage controller has a very hard time trying to keep up with Exchange. So you get into the situation where you size a deployment to actually rely on the performance of that fast tier of storage, but you can't actually use that fast tier of storage when you need to. And you end up with an undersized deployment that was actually really expensive, because these solutions are often not super cheap. There are lower-end solutions around this. Spaces in Windows Server will do some tiering for you. Don't use it for Exchange, please. Very cool for some workloads, not for Exchange. So just be aware of that. When you deploy storage with Exchange, you know, we've been talking for years about the move to less complex, cheaper storage options like DAS. Storage controllers that sit in front of DAS storage, the SAS adapters that sit in the server that connect to the drives, typically have some sort of caching available, right? They're doing some sort of smart caching of data that's flowing through them. What we found is that, and to be clear, I'm very specifically talking about DAS scenarios here. I'm not talking about SAN controllers with large amounts of cache. DAS controllers only here. What we found is that for the mailbox role or for multi-role servers, there's really no point to having any read cache configured for those machines. We really get the benefit from write cache. So if your controller has the ability to tune how it's going to use the memory for cache, and many of them do, move that slider all the way over to the write side, write with a W. You want 100% write cache. If we're talking about other roles, if we're not talking about mailbox or multi-role, we actually do internally for our large deployments do a 25% write, 75% read mix. But for the machines where it really matters, quite frankly, which are your mailbox role machines and your multi-role machines, 100% write cache. You'll get a a very nice benefit from that. SSL offload back in Exchange 2013 SP1. Anybody excited about that out of curiosity? Anyone actually going to use SSL offload? Okay. Awesome. Glad I worked on it. that's okay. So we brought SSL offload back. I'm not going to spend more than a couple seconds talking about it then, given the level of interest. But essentially what it allows you to do is offload processing of the encryption associated with SSL to a network device that's sitting in front of Exchange. So you could essentially terminate your inbound network connections on your load balancer, let your load balancer deal with SSL, and then run non-encrypted HTTP between your load balancer and your CAS servers or your multi-role servers. What that results in is a little bit of a CPU reduction on those servers because they don't have to deal with the SSL overhead. So this is a way to get a little bit of additional perf out of your CAS or your multi-role servers. And typically, the load balancer devices that we often see customers using these days, particularly the larger scale ones that you might have needed to purchase for 2010 and have laying around and want to take advantage of, they often have some dedicated hardware for performing these SSL calculations in a much more efficient manner than a normal, generic CPU that you would have running in your Exchange server. So it ends up being a better utilization of hardware overall, but it does add some complexity. So the benefit here is not all that great, unless you have a really specific reason to do it. Probably don't use SSL offload. So for virtualization, this is the only slide that I have to really talk about virtualization here. Like I mentioned, there's a recording on channel 9 that you can go to get an hour and 15 minutes of detail about our best practices for deploying Exchange virtualized if you want to go there. When we think about performance and tuning, the general point here, don't overcommit anything. Right? Don't overcommit CPU. Don't overcommit memory. Those are really the two things you would overcommit. So don't do that for Exchange. Size, using our sizing guidance, as if you were sizing for physical, there's a process that you use to add some overhead for virtualization, and then dedicate those resources to Exchange. We need to make sure that we can get to those resources when we need them. And probably the biggest, well, there's really two primary examples of perf issues that we see in the field with virtualized Exchange. One of them is overcommitted CPU. So the CPU wasn't sized properly, and we end up with not being able to get access to the CPU resources we need, so the system essentially runs really slowly. The other less common scenario that we see is memory overcommit. And this could be dynamic memory for Hyper-V. VMware has technology that will allow you to overcommit memory, and in various scenarios, we'll do the same thing that Hyper-V's dynamic memory does, where it will, through the ballooning driver in a virtual machine, actually force the services or the processes on a machine to use less memory and give some memory back so that other virtual machines can utilize it. Exchange does not deal with that well at all. We allocate a whole bunch of memory for the database cache when we start up. And when we see these types of scenarios happening, what you end up with is a bunch of your database cache paged out to the page file, which really hurts performance. So don't overcommit memory, don't overcommit CPU. Those are really the two key points here. AD is a really critical dependency for Exchange, super critical. And AD performance really equates to Exchange performance. If you undersize your ADs, or if you have ADs that are under an extreme amount of pressure from a performance perspective, Exchange is going to feel it. Your end users are going to feel it. Exchange is going to feel it really with everything that it does. You have the potential to build queues. Latency of all the processing happening on the box is going to go up. And obviously, anything directory related that your users are doing is going to take longer. Authentication is going to take longer. So ensuring that AD is healthy is really key for a healthy Exchange deployment. There's a couple of things to watch for here. So in general, I think probably the most critical thing that we care about from an AD performance perspective is the amount of time that LDAP searches are taking. We do LDAP reads and writes as well, but searches are the things that that tend to be the best indicator of AD health for us. So we have some performance counters on Exchange that give you some insight into how long those operations are taking. There's actually an instance of that performance counter, the LDAP search time counter, for every domain controller that the Exchange server is talking to. So you can get some insight into which of your Active Directory servers are actually causing problems. You might see a spike for a particular domain controller at a point in time. That gives you some evidence to go investigate that particular machine versus just knowing that, you know, my AD queries are slow. You know, of the 10 domain controllers that I have, where do I start? So this helps to point in the right direction. CPU time on your DCs is also a really key thing to monitor. Processor utilization in general. So if processor utilization is high, Exchange is going to hurt. You want to make sure that that's remaining low. Now, Windows actually provides some great diagnostics for AD performance. If you fire up Perfmon on any of our supported platforms for AD with Exchange 2013, there's some data collector sets that are installed by default by Windows. One of them is the Active Directory Diagnostics data collector set. You can start that data collector set, let it collect information, it'll collect perf counters, and it'll collect some tracing information from Active Directory. And while the problem is occurring, it'll go looking for issues, and looking for queries that are taking a long time, where those queries are coming from, and it'll even actually make some recommendations about how to tune things. Once you stop that data collector set, you can view a report that is a fairly straightforward, easy-to-read report that describes what the potential problems are. So highly recommend using that if you see problems with your DCs. We do recommend actually deploying enough RAM on your DCs to cache the entire AD database in memory. This usually isn't too big of a problem. RAM is actually fairly cheap these days. And the AD database is typically a reasonable size. This tends to be a problem more when you're looking at deployments that are using SMIME, uploading a lot of certs into AD. Photos have, you know, bloated these databases a little bit. But in general, it's certainly doable to actually deploy enough RAM to cache the database. It makes a huge difference to the performance of Exchange to do that. So if at all possible, deploy enough memory on these servers to do that. And while we're talking about Active Directory, kind of the last major point about tuning Windows and the platform under us, we have, over the years, seen a number of issues with NTLM authentication and bottlenecks. I wanted to bring this up just to make sure that everyone in the room is aware of this. Anyone in the room actually had a problem with NTLM auth bottlenecks, Max Concurrent API? I see a few hands. So, yeah, more hands. Okay. So this still is a potential issue with Exchange 2013. Wanted to make sure you all are aware of it. There's a document available that actually describes in great detail what the issue is, how to tune the parameters in Windows to try and avoid this, and that's the link at the bottom. But in a nutshell, the issue here is that when you're using NTLM, NTLM utilizes RPC calls between a client and a domain controller to perform authentication. And those RPC calls are essentially what are represented in the perf counters that I'm showing here. So there's a limit to the number of threads that can process those RPC calls at any moment in time. It's a fairly low limit. It used to be 2. It is 2 in Windows Server 2008 R2. In Server 2012, they bumped it up to 10. So for Server 2012 and 2012 R2, the number is 10. But at any point in time, it will only perform that number of authentication operations against a DC simultaneously. The problem that can occur here is, as an example, hypothetical scenario, I have an array of, well, I shouldn't use the term array. I have a set of CAS servers. CAS array actually used to mean something, so I won't use the term array. I have a set of CAS servers, and they're load balanced. Right, I have a load balancer sitting in front of them. One or more of those CAS servers fails and goes out of the load balanced array. Now, I have a bunch of Outlook clients that are using Outlook Anywhere. that just lost their connection to their server. They're going to reconnect, and Outlook is really good about reconnecting. It's going to get right back on that reconnection as soon as it possibly can. As soon as it notices that the connection went down, it's going to fire up another connection to that load balance VIP and try and reconnect. So you potentially have, let's say we have 1,000 Outlook clients running through each of our CAS servers. Let's say we now have 1,000 users or 1,000 clients trying to reconnect simultaneously and authenticate simultaneously. Well, we can run into this bottleneck. And this can result in timeouts, potentially, from an authentication process. And so you end up in this loop where you have clients attempting to re-authenticate and continuing to kind of clog the pipes here. It actually becomes even more of a problem when you have multiple domains and trusts, because these RPCs actually have to go from CAS server to domain controller in the domain where the CAS servers live, and then from there, the domain where the actual account lives. So you can also run into this bottleneck on local domain controllers as they run these RPCs to remote domains to try and perform the authentication. So these counters are worth monitoring both on CAS servers, mailbox servers, multi-role servers, as well as your domain controllers. Semaphore waiters means the number of requests that are basically in queue waiting for the ability to perform an authentication. This should always be a really low number. By really low, I mean zero. Semaphore holders, this is the number of requests that are actually being serviced currently. That's going to be limited by the limits that I described. Acquires means essentially the number of operations that have been performed. Timeouts is fairly obvious. And the hold time means the average amount of time that it's taking to actually process one of these requests. So there's a formula in the document that describes how to compute, if you're running into bottlenecks here, how to compute the right values, the right new limits, essentially, to use. There's a reg key override to avoid problems here. So enough said on that. So let's talk about balance. I mentioned that balance is a really key thing for Exchange. It's very critical for Exchange 2013 to consider balance in a bunch of different ways for a healthy deployment. I've mentioned load balancing a number of times today. I'm going to mention it again now. So when I talk about load balancing, what I'm referring to is really just making sure that each one of the CAS servers in the deployment is getting approximately the same amount of load, right? I'm hoping that everyone in the room has heard our guidance over the years that using Windows NLB as a load balancing technology is not a great idea. I'm going to continue saying that now. Don't use Windows NLB unless you absolutely have to. Windows NLB is not aware of the health of Exchange. So if Exchange becomes unhealthy, it won't remove a CAS server from the array of or the set of machines that it's load balancing across. That's a problem, right? We want to make sure that load balancing technology can actually pull a machine out and make sure that users can continue to connect to healthy machines. It's really critical. So if at all possible, use a hardware load balancer or use one of the many virtual editions of hardware load balancers. You can get VMs from the vast majority of load balancer vendors today that include all of the technology that exists in their hardware device. And allow you to deploy much more cheaply if you have some machines running a hypervisor available. Much better off than using NLB. But what's critical to think about here is how you're actually going to distribute traffic. We've seen a lot of problems over the years with the types of load balancing policies that are used. In other words, the configuration parameter that sets how we're going to distribute traffic. Load balancers typically have a number of options here. Round robin is certainly one, where you literally take every request and just move through the list of CAS servers. Each request goes to a different CAS server. Very simple. Least connections is another option, where the load balancer actually maintains some statistics about the number of connections that it's managing going to each one of those CAS servers. And as a new connection comes in, it picks the one with the least number of connections and sends the connection over to that machine. Sounds great in theory. Not so great when you have an outage, right? If you think about how this works, let's say I lose a CAS server. fine. The load balancer is going to realize that it lost the CAS server, and it's going to, as new connections come in for the reconnect process, spread them out, you know, assuming that you've got a fairly equal distribution amongst those remaining CAS servers. That's fine. Now, let's say you have another outage shortly after you've brought up the CAS server that failed. The problem that you run into here is that CAS server that failed that you've repaired or brought back online is now going to get probably all of those connections. And it's going to be completely overwhelmed. Login is a fairly expensive thing for Exchange to do, for Exchange to handle. Now, I've described a scenario where you dealt with two failures. How often does that happen? Now think about patching, right? Patching is a fairly frequent thing. Hopefully you all keep your servers patched. You're deploying security patches as they come out, deploying updates to Exchange as they come out. Well, now this actually becomes much more likely. So round robin is actually a really good choice, just generically, for a way to distribute traffic in an Exchange deployment. So in general, if you have the choice and don't have a reason to otherwise, round robin's the way to go. In the scenario that I described, where you have servers coming up and going down, you may discover that protocols that use long-lived connections, like Outlook Anywhere, actually result in kind of an imbalance in connections to these machines over time. So you may end up with some machines that have dramatically more connections going to them. But over a period of days or weeks, those differences will diminish, and you'll end up with a fairly equal spread between them. So round robin is a good way to go. The concurrent connections counter that I have up here is a great way to get an idea on your CAS servers of approximately how many connections they're servicing. That wouldn't include POP, IMAP, SMTP, UM-type connections. That's just connections coming in from the HTTP proxy. But for Exchange, the vast majority of our connections are HTTP-based today, so you'll see them reflected in that counter. Balancing within the database availability group is also super important. So in normal operation, you want to have a good balance of active copies across all your servers. This seems very straightforward, very obvious. But what you'll find is that over time, you move away from this well-balanced state. You know, managed availability may be making decisions for you behind the scenes that something went wrong, and so we activate a copy of a database on a different server. You may deal with failovers or even manual switchovers for patching that result in things getting unbalanced. When you think about best practices, ways to deal with user distribution across databases, we recommend distributing users fairly equally across databases. So all of your databases are theoretically going to have about the same amount of utilization. And this is really the big lever to determine how much utilization each one of these mailbox role or multi-role servers is going to see, the number of active database copies. So in normal utilization, this should be equal across all of the mailbox servers in the DAG. The counter at the bottom actually gives you a sum of the number of active database copies that Active Manager is dealing with on the machine. Basically the total counter gives you the total of a bunch of flags that are either 0 or 1 for each database as an instance. So the total counter gives you the number of copies that are actively mounted. You do have the ability to use this big lever to deal with problems. Because this big lever really defines how much utilization a mailbox server is going to be dealing with, you can move load around very easily just by performing a manual switchover, by activating a few other copies that are, you know, on the problem server on other servers. It's a great way to very quickly try and mitigate a performance problem that you're seeing on a mailbox or a multi-role machine. But having said that, you know, you want to come back to that well-balanced state. And there's a script that ships with Exchange called redistributeactivedatabases.ps1. It's in the scripts directory. And that'll actually go through and look at the activation preferences that you set when you configured your databases and redistribute things to, you know, the best possible configuration. You can run it. There's parameters that allow you to run it and have it tell you what it would do without actually making any changes. You can do that to get familiar with how to use it. There are people who actually schedule this in Task Manager to make sure that things are getting moved back around to the best possible distribution. So within databases, we want to aim for equal space utilization. So keeping an eye on the size of a database as well as the amount of white space within that database, where white space is usable space in the database that that's consumed on disk, but if I moved a mailbox into that database, it would be able to use that white space. You want to make sure that as much as possible you're balancing space utilization. We recommend keeping an eye on this regularly. You know, you can dump out the size of mailboxes on databases, dump out the space consumption, dump out the white space, and actually make some decisions in Excel about ways to move users around. Given that we have online move mailbox, you could do this every day if you wanted, and actually balance things in a really nice way to make sure that you're not going to potentially run out of space on a single database. We do this in an automated way in Office 365, and essentially you could think of this as think of us as always running mailbox moves, really a lot of mailbox moves. Not easy to automate generically, which I think is why it's not built into the product at the moment, but you know, we have found a way to do it in an automated way specific to how we deploy Office 365. You may be able to automate it in a way that works for your deployment. So within mailboxes, we also want to think about balance. And what I mean here are mailboxes with lots of items in them. So we do have some guidance out there that actually defines limits for Office 365 for number of items and folders, number of folders in the hierarchy, these types of limits. And there are actually ways that you can enforce those same limits on your users with an on-premises deployment of Exchange 2013 via the set mailbox commandlet. I provided a link on the slide that will actually show you the limits that we have for Office 365. And those are really best practices for our on-premises deployments as well. They'll help to keep mailboxes healthy, help to deal with client access to those mailboxes, and make sure that things are performing well. So worth taking a look at, and if you're in a situation where you feel that you can enforce those parameters on your users, I would highly encourage you to do so, and set those quotas via set mailbox. Multi-role, in general, we say just do it. It simplifies deployments, gives you a better utilization of hardware. What I'm talking about here is deploying CAS 2013 and Mailbox 2013 on the same machines. We really recommend this as a best practice, and we think that you're going to have the best experience with Exchange if you do this. I almost always get the question here, how do you deploy internally? Well, do as we say, not as we do. So we don't deploy multi-role in Exchange online. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that that aren't really germane to why we're actually making the recommendation here. So ignore the fact that we don't do it internally. We really think that you're going to have the best possible experience with a multi-role deployment. So keep that in mind. Scaling up. Really bad for Exchange. We're designed for scale out. When we were architecting the product, we were thinking primarily about relatively small commodity servers, you know, 2 proc, maybe 12 to 20 core machines with built-in DAS storage. We weren't thinking about quad proc, you know, 40, 80 cores, some number like that, with a terabyte of RAM. Exchange is not designed for that kind of hardware. And if you're deploying that type of hardware for Exchange, you probably should be thinking about virtualization, thinking about ways to divide up the resources on that machine so that you end up with smaller Exchange servers, more of them within a DAG, so that you can take advantage of some of the high availability functionality within Exchange. Scaling up Exchange is bad for perf. We don't really test on that type of hardware, so we don't really even know all of the problems that you're going to run into. But from an HA perspective, we don't want you to put all your eggs in one basket, right? We want the impact of a server failure to be as minimal as possible. And you do that by scaling out. That's really the way that you stay aligned with our high availability philosophy and get the best HA for Exchange. So let's spend a few minutes talking about troubleshooting. So if you're troubleshooting a perf problem, where do you begin? And this can be challenging. I deal with perf problems, perf escalations sometimes, where the problem has gone on for so long that everything's broken, right? Everything's slow. There's 100 different symptoms. Where do you begin? The place I always recommend taking a look is, you know, the low-level resources. Where are we actually hitting bottlenecks? Is CPU high? Are we bottlenecked on network? Are we bottlenecked on storage? Are we having a memory problem? Potentially, the answer is yes to all. That does happen. Sorry if you're in that situation, but that does happen. And actually, in those scenarios where, you know, you have 100 symptoms, very often that's what's going on. You are so undersized or so overloaded that everything on the system is not working. And there's really a very simple answer to that problem. Add more servers. Or if it's a storage bottleneck and you're using shared storage, you may have some more work to do on that end of the system. But you know, I say that kind of flippantly, like it's easy to add more servers. If you're virtualized, it actually might be. And I've certainly worked with customers who've run into that type of problem and have been able to bring up, you know, a couple of additional Exchange servers overnight and see some great mitigation of the problem. So if you're virtualized and you have that ability to bring up new VMs, that's often a great way to kind of tactically go and approach the problem. So a couple of things that we want to define up front. Specific symptoms, so that once we're kind of through the process, we can go look at those symptoms again and check them off and make sure that we've solved them or that we've at least made progress. And what resources are impacted, what physical resources in the system are actually impacted. And then we're going to start high level. We're going to start with those very broad resources and kind of work our way down. I'm not going to go into super low level detail today. I'm just trying to provide a general structure for how to think about these problems, but hopefully this provides some help. So we always do recommend prioritizing service availability. This is something that we've spent a lot of time since we've been working on Exchange Online thinking through and thinking about how we collect information, yet very quickly turn around and bring things back online as quickly as possible. We want to make sure that we're having the least impact on end users as we possibly can. So an example of this would be a high CPU event. Well, it's possible that a service is in a bad state that'll be resolved by restarting the service. And in some cases, we actually do that in an automated way in Exchange Online. If we see a high CPU event, we'll actually, in an automated way, go collect some data and restart the service. And we'll try that a few times to see if the problem goes away. By collecting data, I mean collecting some process dumps or potentially using some internal tools that actually profile what's going on inside the process. But you know, it may actually make sense to just try restarting the service and see if the problem goes away. Prioritize service availability. That's the key. So high CPU issues, probably the most common problem we see. So important question to answer. Where is the CPU actually going? Is it just broadly high CPU across the machine and, you know, all the Exchange processes are using more CPU than we typically see? Is it a single process that's using a bunch of CPU? Or are we actually seeing a whole bunch of kernel mode privileged CPU time that might be indicative of a driver or a hardware problem? I've seen issues where the privileged time CPU was extremely high, and it turned out that it was like a bad keyboard port on a server that was sending a whole bunch of interrupts that the kernel was having to deal with, kind of in a loop, and causing CPU to be really high. Nothing to do with Exchange. Just a hardware problem that resulted in you know, needing to be repaired. Showed up as a CPU problem, though. So the processor counters actually give you an idea of where that CPU is going in terms of kernel mode, the privileged time CPU, or user time, which would be the processes that are actually the services that are running application type work, like Exchange. So that mix we'll give you a sense of whether this is potentially a driver or hardware problem or something more in the application space. For user mode CPU, you can actually use the process counters to look at which specific processes are consuming CPU. You can also do this by bringing up Task Manager, basically the same thing, and looking at the list of processes and services and seeing where that CPU is going. It really helps to have a baseline. And when I talk about trending in a couple of minutes, that's where that baseline comes from. It really helps to have a baseline to understand the difference between what you see normally and what you're seeing today. If you have that baseline, then you can try and figure out whether or not load might be playing a part in this, right? If the number of operations that Exchange is processing has dramatically increased, and the CPU has gone up as well. Well, this is probably load related. But if the CPU has just gone up and the amount of work that the server is doing, the number of messages that it's processing, the number of RPC operations that are running is the same, well, that's probably not load related. That's more likely going to be a bug or some other type of issue, maybe integration with a third-party product that's causing problems here. So if you have a baseline and you can actually look at RPC operations per second, the message traffic counters, et cetera, to figure out whether or not things have increased, that'll help you to determine if it's load related. And if it is load related, you can consider rebalancing usage by moving database active copies around, like I described earlier. Important to keep in mind that workload management in Exchange 2013 will actually use available CPU cycles to perform background work. And by background work, I mean things like mailbox moves, store maintenance. A lot of the things that we had as scheduled maintenance in prior versions of the product actually run as workload management tasks. So if CPU goes relatively low on the machine, workload management may kick off some of that work to take advantage of that CPU. And as load increases, it will back off that you know, lower priority work and allow the user processing to take over. So you can use the counters that I've shown on the slide to actually get an idea of whether or not these things are happening. Things like mailbox assistance will also be included in this. They actually perform a fair amount of work that'll consume CPU. So it's worth keeping an eye on those counters as well. Memory utilization can be a big problem with Exchange. As I mentioned, the vast majority of our memory is used, is allocated via the .NET framework. And so as a result, a number of the key counters to keep an eye on for memory health are actually .NET counters. The percent time in GC, the amount of time essentially that we're spending garbage collecting. In other words, going through and figuring out what memory is not actually being used anymore that can be deallocated and reused when we need it on demand. That should always be less than 10% for all the processes that are running on the box. If you're seeing that very high, well, that may actually be an indicator that you don't have enough RAM on the machine. And that .NET is under so much memory pressure because there's not enough physical RAM that it needs to be more aggressive about trying to garbage collect things out of its heaps. The number of, I mentioned already the percent committed bytes and the available megabytes counters as well. The other three counters are just general things to keep an eye on that you might want to trend over time. Number of bytes in all heaps, total amount of memory that .NET has allocated. Private bytes for each process. It's essentially the amount of memory that process has allocated. And working set is the subset of private bytes, essentially, that is physically in RAM as opposed to being in the page file. In terms of storage, we actually haven't changed our guidance on storage latencies at all from 2010. So the counters that I've listed here are the same ones that we've been advising you to keep an eye on for a couple of releases now. And these are really critical to make sure that you have a healthy Exchange deployment. If storage latencies go high, Exchange is going to be slow, period. There's no way around that. And running a tool like JetStress on your storage solution before you deploy is a great way to make sure that you're going to be good to go here. But keeping an eye on these over time, alerting on them if they go outside of these thresholds, is a good way to see that you have a potential storage issue. If you do, there's a number of things that can influence or can cause storage problems. Disk health, you know, a disk is going bad. You can get high latency to I/O on that individual disk. The overall array of drives can cause problems. You know, you may be doing a rebuild because one of the drives in a RAID array had problems. That will slow down all of the operations to that array while the array rebuilds. You could actually have high I/O running to a drive. And it might actually not even be Exchange I/O. It might be something else that's reading or writing from that drive. Antivirus utilities, as an example, can cause problems here. Controller performance, you know, something between the application and the disks themselves. Controllers can have problems. And any sort of connectivity issue as well. So higher than expected I/O, you can monitor from an Exchange perspective via these counters. And this is another place where it's nice to have a baseline to be able to see in normal operation, what do these look like on average? What do they look like now? Sysinternal's process monitor actually gives you the ability to go look at all of the I/O that's happening in a given location, in a given path and on a given volume, et cetera, to understand whether or not all of that I/O is actually exchange I/O, or if there's something else going on there. You know, if someone has started a copy process to move some stuff around that's actually impacting exchange, this is a great way to figure that out. You can filter on specific locations. The duration column that you can add to the report actually shows you how long those IOs are taking as well. So great way to try and troubleshoot those problems. I do recommend the one counter to rule them all. This is my favorite counter in Exchange, RPC average latency. It used to be RPC averaged latency on the old version of Store and Exchange 2010 and earlier. But since we rewrote Store, apparently we had to change the name of the counter. I don't know. So RPC average latency, we want to see, in general, less than 100 milliseconds. I actually recommend 50 milliseconds as a good threshold here, but the one we've published over the years is 100. So we'll keep that for consistency. This is really the amount of time that each transaction to Store is taking. So if there are CPU problems, if there are network problems, if there are storage problems on the box, they will very often be reflected in this counter. So if you're going to watch one thing, if you're going to trend one thing on your Exchange servers, it's that RPC average latency counter for your Exchange, for the individual databases. That's the one you want to watch. The second one actually breaks it out per client type. So you can see how long OAuth transactions are taking, how long Outlook transactions are taking, et cetera. If in doubt, call Microsoft. We actually have a whole bunch of fantastic folks in support who understand very well how to troubleshoot Exchange Perf. You may end up talking to me. I'll give you the line that Tim McMichael likes to say for DAG troubleshooting. If you end up on the phone with me, you are in a world of hurt. It's really bad, so hopefully you don't end up on the phone with me. But that's, you know, hopefully I've given you a few ideas about ways to troubleshoot. Microsoft support is a great way to, great next step if you can't solve the problem on your own. So trending, last couple of minutes here. EDS, the Exchange Diagnostic Service, installed on every Exchange 2013 server and logging perf data. There's perf logs in the diagnostics directory under the Exchange install path that you can't really turn off. It's actually logging in the same way that you would if you went into perfmon and created a counter set. But what you'll find is that if you go in and delete those counter sets, that EDS will actually very nicely go and recreate them for you and start them up again. So it'll collect up to 5 gigs of perf logs, and it'll purge out the old ones for you. And it collects all the counters that we think are relevant for troubleshooting issues on an Exchange server. You can use these as well. They're not for us. I mean, they're not getting uploaded to Microsoft or anything. They're really there for you or for Microsoft to help you troubleshoot an issue if you run into something. You can tune the amount of space that's used for these logs. So if you want to hold on to more data, you can change this parameter that I mentioned here to hold on to more data. If you want to scale it back, you could do that as well, but I wouldn't recommend that. We actually want that volume of data available if we need it. You can load this into SQL and build yourself a data warehouse. There's a tool that ships with Windows called Relog that can be used typically to change like a binary perf log to CSV so you can load it into Excel. You can also say instead of converting it to CSV, I want to load it into SQL. So if you have a SQL server with some available storage and you have perms on a database on that SQL server, you can fairly easily just go through each one of these perf logs. You can actually script this and upload them into SQL. You end up with a table that you can then point Excel at and potentially create some pivot tables and trend perf counters over time in a fairly straightforward way. Now, SQL is not going to natively be tuned to deal with this large volume of perf data. So you may end up having to have some fun with analysis services or following the guidance that SQL will produce on indexes that might need to be created to speed up query performance. Be aware of that. It isn't just going to work beautifully out of the box, especially if you have a lot of servers that you're uploading data for. But hopefully this gives you an idea of what you could potentially do and then produce some reports over time. And last recommendation I'm going to make here, if you do this, or actually even if you don't load data into SQL, build yourself a scorecard. Create some goals. Figure out what health is on your servers and track it over time. This is something that we do internally for our service, and we look at this on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. Monthly being a report out to some to execs, essentially, showing, you know, how are we doing against these health metrics? How are we doing in keeping CPU low? How are we doing on mail flow? How is mail flow trending? You know, if we see mail flow trending up over time, does that mean we need to make capacity decisions? Do we need to add more machines? Is that going to change the output of the exchange calculator in such a way that we need to add more servers or add more storage? If you get into this rhythm of reporting and trending, you'll find that you can be much more proactive about making sure that your system remains healthy. So that's really the critical point here. Set targets and hold yourself to those targets. And think about, of those targets, which of those will result in you needing to add more machines, right? That's the key. So, quick summary. And I'm probably gonna have time for one or two questions, and then we'll maybe adjourn to the office booth downstairs, or to lunch, I guess. So, proper sizing, probably the most critical thing to make sure that you're healthy from a perf perspective, right? Balance is key. Making sure that you're actually getting the best utilization of your hardware, super important. Multi-role should always be the goal, right? We want to make sure that we're deploying multi-role servers. We think those are going to give you the best utilization of hardware. There's a number of other benefits as well. Baselines, extremely helpful. If you can collect perf data over time, it'll give you a much better idea of whether or not the problem that you're seeing today is load-related or you know, something else, and can give you a lot of clues about where to take your troubleshooting process. And then, if at all possible, keep a data warehouse of this information that we're collecting for you. I wish we could go and, you know, really, truly collect it for you and provide a whole bunch of additional reporting. Maybe we'll get there in some future release. It's not there today. We've taken the first step with making sure that for each exchange server, there's a set of data available for you to do with whatever you like. So with that, I will go ahead and take a couple of questions. I'm already like 2 minutes over, so I'm going to hold it to two questions. The link for the slide deck is at the bottom again, and I'll come back to the slide just so you can see that link. But if you want to come and ask me questions, I will be at the Office Servers and Services booth in the Go Deploy section tomorrow at 10:45. Happy to talk to any of you who have further questions, and we can chat in the hallway afterwards as well after I take a couple. So thank you very much. And if you want to ask a question, grab a mic, please. Sure. So the question was, I said that it was better to scale out versus scale up. Where do we draw the line? What's the best practice there? So there is no hard and fast rule, and the reason for that is user profiles are different. You know, the way individual users use the machines is going to be different. So we can't really provide a, you know, if you're running greater than 4,000 users, you should consider multiple machines, that type of thing. What I generally recommend is that you look at the comments I made about the architecture of Exchange and the type of hardware we were thinking about for our architecture, commodity server platforms, two CPU with whatever number of cores are realistic for today's deployments on those CPUs, the amount of storage that you can fit in one of those boxes, and look at the workload that you're running, figure out how many users you could fit on that platform, regardless of whether you're going to use that platform, and that's really the number of users you should target. So we see, you know, in the low thousands of users, 3,000-ish users, as a common sort of best practice for users per server in normal operation. Yep. I'll take one more if anybody has one more question. Yep.
Do you still recommend not putting antivirus on the server itself?
Question is, do you recommend not putting any antivirus on the server itself? No. Please use antivirus utilities. Very, very important for healthy server deployments. We want to make sure that we catch viruses on those machines. But we do have guidance. I honestly don't know if we have a specific piece of guidance for 2013 or if we just have the 2010 guidance out there. But in general, exclude Exchange processes from the antivirus configuration. So, and exclude the directories that Exchange is using for databases specifically. So in other words, we don't want the scanner to get in the way of critical Exchange I/O, but we do want the scanner to deal with anything that might infect other areas of the system. That's the key. All right, thanks. I'm going to jump off the stage, and we can take more questions out in the hall if anyone has them. Thanks.